This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith, here with Kathy Sheppes.
Hi, everyone.
And our guests in the studio this evening are Salome Shrestha.
Hello. And very happy to be here.
Hello. Your brand is called Agati, and you're from San Francisco.
I am originally from India.
Oh, okay.
I've traveled around a lot, but right now I call San Francisco my home.
All right. So your brand is San Francisco-based, as are you.
Yes.
Okay. And you make eco-conscious clothing using artisans from India and Nepal.
That is very right.
Okay. And then also here is Nicole Heim, co-founder and creative director at CN, which is a New York-based women's ready-to-wear brand launched in 2015. And she was at the Copenhagen Fashion Summit recently, which we're going to talk about. And we were also at the LIM Sustainability Conference, speaking on separate panels, but kind of at the same time. And then Luna Atamian Han Peterson.
Correct.
Is here. Hi, Luna.
Hi. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, and Nicole, say hello.
Hello.
Oh, so people know that's you when you speak. Okay. Luna is from Salter Baxter Consulting, and she had a recent Business of Fashion article about millennials saying that they care about ethical fashion, but shopping otherwise. And she has fresh data and numbers about ethical fashion and sustainability. So it's a sustainability episode that we're doing here. Kathy, who should we start with?
Well, let's just start from the left side and move around.
Okay.
So we'll start with Nicole.
Nicole, tell us about your brand.
Wow. In a nutshell, we're a women's wear brand called CN. We're based here in New York. We've been around for a few years. And we focus on basically sustainability across our supply chain, materials being our biggest area of focus. And we kind of really believe that design should lead the way. So we're really interested in kind of using creativity to do that. And so materials being our biggest area of focus. And then we make everything here in New York. And we just like to be really kind of thoughtful about every part of the business.
So something I think would also just be great to mention, because we may come back to it, is that you are a finalist with the CFDA Lexus Initiative.
Yeah, so we're currently one of five finalists in the CFDA Lexus Fashion Initiative, which is a sustainability competition and business program that started November 2017 and concludes in about 2 weeks, actually. And basically, through a number of resources and mentors and various different kind of challenges and micro awards and things, a little bit of grant funding, we basically built this kind of blueprint of sustainability for our brand, and that's what we will be pitching in about 2 weeks. And there's one winner with a cash prize at the end. And basically that allows you to kind of invest that money into your sustainability initiatives within your brand.
Salome, tell us about Agati.
So starting with what does Agati mean? Because I keep getting that question a lot. It is
you capitalize every letter. Is it a abbreviation for like 12 words?
No, it is actually derived from the word agati, where there is one A less, a Sanskrit word. I've always been fascinated with the sounds of Sanskrit words, and it means origin, the origin of something, the arrival of something.
There's one A less?
In the original Sanskrit word.
Oh, okay.
And,
So you start with A-A-G-A-T-I.
No, I start with A-G. A-A-T-I,
okay.
Whereas the original word is A-G-A-T-I. So there is one less A.
Okay.
In the triple A.
Yeah. But in Sanskrit, there was no A.
Oh, the English version.
The
of
English
it.
Version
yeah.
of Sanskrit.
I
okay.
mean, if I had to get the script of Sanskrit, then, you know, no one in America or the rest of outside India would understand it. So.
And no one speaks yeah. Sanskrit. We don't even know what it sounded like. So.
Agati.
Yes.
That is the original sound.
Okay.
And now the way we have kind of modified it to my version is Agati. And I design one-of-a-kind eco-conscious designs where the focus is on makers and nature. Where it may sound a little bit overwhelming that, oh, you're covering so much out there, but I feel it is doable over time. So we work with a lot of eco-friendly textile. Mm-hmm. And within textile, there is a lot of focus on hand-weaved textile, where I go and visit the rural villages in India and find these weavers who have extremely well-crafted, you know, skills, and bring them to modern contemporary designs for the urban women right now in America, and hopefully will expand in the future.
For many cultures, textiles are sacred.
Yes, it is.
And, particularly in India, we had a fascinating conversation with Anita Dongra about the artisans that she works with, and some will not put animal designs into their textiles. She wants a bird in there, but she has to use people from a different village to create those textiles because certain people don't ever depict living animals in their textiles.
There are amazing stories to how culture is actually, you know, sort of respectfully brought into the stories of textiles. And I mean, Anita Dongre is, she's, you know, a great example when it comes to bringing hand-weaved textile to the forefront of contemporary designs. And we are actually, you know, working on another future project where it is something very spiritual to the artists, but we are working on a very carefully planned manner to bring just the elements around the deity and not the deity into the textile design. So you're right, there is a lot of belief and we have to work on it very carefully and make sure there is no misappropriation done to their you know, designs and history.
How do you work with that back and forth? What's your approach to working with people who have those sorts of rules in the things that they're able to provide to you?
I think one thing I've been blessed with is being born in India. I was in the forefront of culture. So I was born in the mountains myself. I'm a Nepalese. So there's so much culture there already. And in India, you know, there are so many states within a few kilometers, languages and within languages, dialect changes. So I was already very much exposed to that beautiful side of it. And then moving on to Singapore, where I spent quite a big time of my life, there was Bali and China and Japan. There's so much you can absorb. So when you actually see my designs, sometimes people do get confused that between collections, oh, there's, you know, so much. But, you know, it's just what my brain has, you know, kind of taken in. And how do I work with them is a language does help in Nepal. That's Nepali is the language. And in India, you know, Hindi is used all over. So it helps. And also, it takes a lot of patience and traveling around. But I really enjoy being actually with the artist and sitting with them and explaining that this is how your art can be transformed and taken to the urban women. So I think that proximity and the travel, being face to face in front of them and sitting and explaining, helps a lot.
Back in 98 or 99, I was in India shooting a documentary for Herman Miller, the furniture company. Mm-hmm. And we had furniture assemblers come across India from Bangalore to Mumbai to assemble this prototype Herman Miller furniture. They were testing it where other furniture companies wouldn't see it. And the furniture assemblers spoke 9 languages amongst themselves and communicated about assembling the furniture largely through hand gestures.
Wow.
Yeah, it was fascinating.
That is an extremely unique situation. They know a lot, but that sounds, even for me too, it's kind of, wow.
India is amazing. It really is. You get that sort of thing here in New York, but most people have started to pick up English.
Mm-hmm. I think what I love about bringing the art of India and Nepal to San Francisco and New York, because that's where we primarily are at the moment, that's where our audience is they love the stories and the way it surprises them and the way they connect with it, you know. And some things are unbelievable for them. They don't know what certain art that I show or, you know, sort of depict in my future project, especially that's coming up, is. And I love the, you know, the surprise element and then the respect that they show back to that art and how, you know, they can actually wear those stories. I think that is what Agathi is also very much about, stories, about narratives, about culture, people, you know, nature. So, yeah.
I think that's something really important as far as sustainability is the story piece of it. And the more stories the consumer starts to understand, I think the faster they'll embrace it.
When I had my first brand, it was very different, right? It was about just creating beautiful stories season after season. And then when now I'm thinking about slow fashion, the term, and how do I want, or how does Agathi want to incorporate and live it with the brand, it's like trying to go seasonless and bringing in the what do you say, the pace of where someone just sits back and enjoys the art. And then the storytelling is becoming even more important in that, you know, so that it kind of cuts back the pace of everything that fast fashion is, you know, taking, has taken us through already and, you know, reached us to a very different consumption level. So I feel storytelling is a great way to connect, reconnect again with the people.
So Luna, talk to me about your business, a fashion article.
Sure. I feel like, you know, my story and my work is probably going to be quite boring after hearing these amazing stories. But yeah, I think to your point, storytelling is everything. And, you know, the article was really about the gap between, you know, we've seen a lot of research about, you know, the rise of the ethical consumers and how consumers, you know, value sustainable products and how they're willing to pay more for that value proposition. But what we're seeing also through, you know, my work working with companies is that it doesn't necessarily translate into purchasing attitudes. And I think storytelling and communication, how brands can sort of articulate that value proposition in a very simple and accessible, and I call it sexy way, is really everything. And, you know, we're, I think, you know, I do believe that sustainability is in a way becoming mainstream, and corporations, you know, are really doing, you know, great things in sort of trying to really communicate their story, connect with consumers. You know, if you take Everlane, for instance, you know, I love seeing pictures of the supply chain or of different factories, different people working, and really allow consumers to have that personal relationship with the product they purchase. So that was the main point of the article.
And with that, I mean, are you seeing that consumers are responding to that or changing behavior because of that? I know I was just reading H&M just, I don't know, they recently opened a division, Arquette, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And whoever the creative director there is, I know fast fashion, just named them one of the most creative people. So I had gone onto the site to look.
Fast company? Okay.
Oh, I had fast fashion in my head. You know, and I went on and they did. It wasn't so much, and I know they're really talking about, you know, getting to higher percentages of sustainability, and they did show the workers, but it didn't really go beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you working with clients or your on sustainability? That is what Salt
right.
Baxter
yeah.
does, right?
So just to give a quick intro, so Salt Baxter is an agency specialized in sustainability and CSR. So we work with companies operating in different sectors, but the fashion and luxury sector is really one of our sweet spot because, you know, we're seeing a lot of demand from companies, you know, coming to us and, you know, trying to, you know, develop a sustainability strategy or improve it or communicate it. Actually, communication is you know, the main sort of request we're getting these days from our companies is how do I connect with my consumers when it comes to sustainability, and how do I make sure the work I'm doing actually resonates with consumer and you know, and sort of drives, you know, that purchasing attitude. And I think at the moment we don't have enough sales data to see, you know, the consequences of that, because this is a relatively new concept and effort. But I'm hopeful that in the next, maybe in the next year or so, we'll be able to see that data.
I think also too, it's almost, and this is in my opinion what we've experienced and probably more specific to luxury fashion, but I think it's a lot about values almost more than strictly sustainability. I think the word sustainability is lacking definition at this point because mm-hmm. it's thrown around so much. Like, what does that even mean? And I think in a way, like especially with luxury, communication is the biggest challenge. We have, as a brand, actually have seen engagement go down when we talk about sustainability as opposed to a design story, right? Because they're coming to us for aesthetic first. And then when they realize the values or the philosophy or the mission and vision behind the brand, it's sort of this added bonus. And I think that with fashion, that's really important. I think when you look at something like food and the movement with food, that's, you know, that's going directly into your body, and it's a little bit of a different emotional connection. They're both extremely important, but I think fashion is still trying to find its angle in some ways of saying, how do we accurately communicate but also keep it sexy and, you know, fun and the allure of fashion, because that's really what it's kind of always been about. So I think it's a really interesting time because we're just like in this huge moment of change, and it's so important, but we're all still kind of figuring it out, at least in my opinion. Yeah.
It's a little bit dangerous to tell the consumers too much about how bad the fashion industry really is, because there could be a massive negative reaction to most of the problems that we have if consumers were really aware of them. I mean, the toxicity of dyes, you know, definitely wash your clothing before you put it on after you buy it, because it's bad stuff. I mean, the color is from bad things. And
I mean, maybe the first thing to take care of is just the amount of waste.
Yeah.
Not necessarily
absolutely
what it's made up of, mm-hmm. you know. I think that's easy for people to maybe relate to.
I think that's probably the most, in my opinion, like that's what keeps me up at night, I think. And I think that's where circularity and all the ideas around circularity is really kind of the shift in business models and how we can completely think about it in different ways. And I think that's where, like, you know, the major opportunity is in terms of trying to keep things in the system and not just, you know, this excess waste.
And it seems as if, you know, if companies are offering made to order, not necessarily on a high, high level. I mean, it could kind of be mid-price level. I mean, is that how maybe
yes.
you're producing? So consumers are willing to wait?
It really varies. There isn't a very clear trend to that. At the moment, I think even the consumers are trying to figure out what they want to be in terms of their own habit. And we've done small researches, you know, with small focus groups. And, you know, as you said, Nicole, there is clearly like the product has to be first aesthetically appealing to them. And then they would kind of care about, okay, you know, what really has gone into the making of it. That's the first win for us. And I think we've tried pre-orders. I think it works sometimes. Sometimes they just don't want to wait. They want to see what is available right now, fits them, and then just kind of they walk away with that. But it's getting popular. And even for companies like us, maybe that is a business model that works well in the end, because we at Agathi try to keep very tight inventory. And, you know, for me, sometimes it's a little bit risky at the same time. I may lose a sale here and there, but I'm ready for that as long as it kind of, you know, builds a good pipeline for the long run. I think, like, just going back to the point of, you know, the cycled loop system, food industry took a long time, right, to kind of pick up. I think our industry is really on a very strong start. When we launched last year and we were doing research on, okay, you know, who else is there, what's happening in this space, yes, there was a lot of good research findings, but as of today, when I sit here, there's so much more. Like, there, when directories come about, okay, who are these beautiful brands doing sustainable clothing? There is so many beautiful brands out there. So there is, you know, even companies really taking the lead on that. And maybe, you know, consumers need to continue, you know, getting the information from us. And we as the brands need to keep developing this, you know, business model, whether eco-friendly, artisanal, social impact, and then just go all out.
I can speak to the made to order a little bit too. This is something that we are only testing, so I should be careful how much I commit to this. But our last spring, summer, 18 seasons, that would be out now on the site. We did a little test where, as I said, we're about 90% made in New York. And so we tested on a a section of styles that we have kind of ready to go, that we have fabric here in New York for, and that we could put made to order on the site and kind of see and put like a, anywhere from a 2 to 4 week lead time, and see kind of experiment and see what would happen. And, you know, I think it, and we need a little more time to get reads on it, but we didn't really see anyone, you know, scaring away from a 3 week lead time. I mean, I think if they understand, you know, this is literally being made in a factory that's 20 blocks from our studio, and it is, you know, it, in some cases it's a $1,200 pant. Like, it's not something you're buying on an impulse or on a whim. And I think, again, that's specific for luxury and specific for, you know, for New York factory and all these different things. But, you know, I think in some cases it can work, or I'm optimistic that it can.
That's encouraging. And I guess then it just has to kind of be seasonless so that you don't get up
Absolutely.
To that point where suddenly waiting 6 weeks puts you into another.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in the same, like, again, this is very local, but we'll have clients here in New York who will come to our studio, and there's opportunity for us to customize as well. If they're willing to wait 3 weeks and there's something that's in stock, fabric-wise, we can do something that's entirely custom, and we will only do that through our direct, you know, e-commerce or offline kind of private clients, just because we don't have the wholesale markup that kind of makes that, you know, it makes it possible for that from that standpoint. But I think all of a sudden you're just getting so much value because it's a completely one of a kind piece. And I think product scarcity is important for lots of reasons. So again, I think how that scales is where it gets really, really tricky. But on a super small level, I think the potential business model that it has, and there's new innovative manufacturers that are also doing that and making it easier for brands, I think we're going to see stuff hopefully emerge.
Do we know anyone that is doing that to scale?
And well, I mean, I think not really. but
I think,
you know,
Misha Nuno is, I don't know, I believe, but only on certain, and I think it's a 3 day.
Okay, yeah,
but
yeah, that's still
yeah.
I mean, I came from a company that was direct to consumer, but we still, even though we did, you know, we cut as the season went along, mm-hmm. but we still had waste and piece goods. So,
mm-hmm. yeah,
the same thing really.
When it comes to scaling, you know, what you mentioned, the circular economy is really key here. How do we make sure that we're constantly reusing, you know, what we are manufacturing? And I think it's interesting because when you look a few years ago when the idea of circular economy appeared, people were very excited, you know, all conversations around sustainability were about the circular economy. And we're seeing more and more now people actually recognizing the limits also of that model. It's not just about recycling, it's also about, you know, the textiles you use and the chemicals you use and sort of the whole supply chain that you need to think about, and not just, you know, how do I recycle.
What sort of knowledge is in demand from consultants on ethical fashion? What are the big companies asking for in terms of information and metrics on the marketplace and that sort of thing from you?
Yeah, I think they're always interested, you know, in obviously the business return, because a good sustainability strategy has to be aligned with the business strategy. That's the way to be sustainable. And, you know, they're interested in consumer behavior, you know, how consumers or millennials are buying, what is the level of information that is required in order to sell this product. You know, when you look at the luxury sector, for instance, it's a very interesting sector because it's almost, you have to separate it from the apparel sector, that balance that you have to find between communicating about sustainability, but still, you know, keeping that mysterious, glamorous aspect is very difficult. So, you know, they're mostly asking about what their competitors are doing, you know, what are the mega trends and what would be the sweet spot for them given their business model.
Are mega trends useful to them? It seems like the currents are changing so quickly now.
They are, and I think that's why we're growing, because there's constantly more work. And I think as a consultant, it's also very interesting. You need to keep track you know, about what competitors are doing, you know, what other industries are doing. And I think the reason why, and not just in the fashion industry, but companies are interested in working with consultants is because we're able to provide that that sort of you know, mega trend understanding of what is going on, you know, outside of your company. And it's very interesting when you work with people working in specific brand, the lack of understanding of, you know, what their competitors are doing, you know, what consumers are requiring them to do. So, yeah, you would be quite surprised.
Even just understanding sustainability.
Exactly.
I mean, it's crazy. It's so complicated. It's not, you know, I think having experts in your corner is like the only way to go. I don't care if you're big or small, just because it's such a complex topic and people are so scared to talk about it. So if you are going to talk about it, I think it's good to feel confident in what you're saying.
So through the Lexis initiative, were you exposed to a lot of organizations that could help you? I mean, were there any that were particularly unique that you were like, wow, I can't believe this?
We've had a few. It's been a mix of individual mentors who have done kind of workshops. And then kind of individual mentorships as well, based on kind of what our brand, you know, focus was. So ours being materials. There's an organization called Class out of Italy, and they have basically been helping us with sourcing materials. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges with materials is, as a small brand or any small to medium-sized business, so which I think is what any business under 50 million. So like, I think, and when you look at a micro business, which is what we would be, getting access to these better materials is incredibly challenging, mostly because of minimums and some of the stuff just not available yet. So by partnering with somebody, they are giving us access to lower minimums and to trying to just help utilize their relationships with mills that they already have. And so that's been really, you know, really huge. And then the Copenhagen Fashion Summit was just great in terms of learning. And then separately, we started working with, or we began the brand working with an organization called Nest. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, based in New York. Yeah, and we too do a lot of artisanal fabrics. And so we worked with them kind of from the start of the brand, just in saying we wanted, again, that external expert to say, can you make sure that we're sourcing from people and that someone's taking care of them? Because we as a brand are so busy designing, we want to make sure that, you know, we're doing what we're best at, and we have somebody who knows that side of it. So through the Lexis program, we were able to kind of deepen that work with them and have a brand membership that allowed us to go a little deeper with the work with the artisan groups that we were already working with. So again, it allowed us to kind of get some new resources, but also strengthen the values and all the work that we had already been doing. So
it's great.
I want to make sure that our listeners know the Copenhagen Fashion Summit, on their website, they have most of the talks posted. So you can actually watch the talks that happened there very recently. This is very up-to-date sustainability and ethical fashion information that can help you with your business and making sure that you're really staying on point with this stuff. It wasn't such a closed conference as most are, that this information is actually out there and you can just watch the videos. Although, what was it like being in the room with all those people who think about that stuff all the time? Did you have good conversations off stage?
Yeah, I mean, they had various different parts of it. So it was a mix of panels and roundtable discussions and service provider one-on-one meetings and forums with textiles. So there was like all sorts of different things happening. You know, I think it was good. You could kind of pick what you needed most, and you were able to kind of curate your experience based off of that. But I think, yeah, we very fortunately, uniquely had some one-on-one time with Stella McCartney after she spoke, which was incredible to have kind of just a very candid conversation with her. And one of the biggest takeaways was that she, you know, was just talking about how hard it is. And even with all of her resources, I mean, those were her words, like with all of our resources and with as far as we've come, it's still extremely difficult for us. And at the end of the day, you know, she's the designer and she's like, I want velvet one season season and the next season I don't want it. And she has a sustainability team who is there, you know, doing all the legwork to make a sustainable velvet. And so she just talked about A, how hard it was, and B, how creative they really have to get with the base kind of materials that they have, and that, you know, it's a work in progress.
Yeah. What's so interesting about Stella McCartney is how they were able to really embed sustainability throughout the brand. I was in a Stella McCartney shop a few days ago because they had big sales. And the sort of the salesperson assisting me knew about sustainability. He was able, you know, when he presented the dress, he specified, you know, the materials and explained how you know, this dress was made. And I thought that was really fascinating because it never happened to me. And I'm sure, you know, there is a training phase that every employee has to go through, which really translate into the customer experience in the shop.
I'm curious if people out there listening, have you seen this in other stores? Have you seen this from other brands? Are they really communicating how ethical fashion works and training the consumers to look for things? We're info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com or at AFPOD on Twitter if you want to shout at us. There's also a feedback form on AmericanFashionPodcast.com. If you want to go through that direction. But let us know what you're seeing in terms of ethical fashion and what's changing that you see.
I think a big part of that is, and Stella McCartney, I mean, it's the core of who she is and what she believes in, right? And that goes back to, Nicole, you talking about, I mean, it has to be equally as important, you know, your interest in sustainability and your interest in design, which I'm sure is how you feel also, Solani, with your product.
Yes. For me, actually, I'm just a very personal story here, was design is obviously critical and at the forefront, and it does get very challenging sometimes. Should I, you know, complicate it? Should it be the design, or should I consider the sustainability part of it first? Because, you know, the textile, the materials, the whole content part of it that puts together finally our design has to be ethically sourced and, you know, very well made without harming nature or the people who work with creating it. So I think it was a challenging, I faced many challenging situations, but it all started with, you know, designing something that was zero waste for me. And I tried a dress that I wouldn't waste even, you know, half an inch of. Very, very complicated process. And I wasn't successful. What I ended up doing was patching up, you know, the pieces into something else and making it look like a blouse. But again, no one's going to buy that blouse. You know, so that is, again, a very major, you know, design complication I think we creatives find. But I think, again, along the process, what I came across was the waste that we, you know, we talk about, the fabric waste. We do all our pattern making manually because, you know, we are very limited edition designs. And one good thing is it is laborious, it is time-taking. But you can actually, alongside like machines also, actually, computers also, they kind of minimize waste while putting the patterns down. We also try our best to kind of, you know, lay it down, minimize all the extras that can be cut away. And what is cut away, either we actually put it back as embroidery and give that textile a second life. And it's quite a lot of intensive hand design that we do with that waste fabric. Or now we found a partner in India who actually take those scrap fabrics and then they make them into mats or, you know, like cushions. And those go to schools of, you know, children who can't really afford chairs. So along the way, you know, while making beautiful designs that have embroidery and drapery as the artisanal side of it, we are also able to kind of fulfill being, you know, sort of recycling, upcycling, or reducing waste. So I think slowly ways will open, you know, the complications will kind of come down because we got to find solutions. So.
And slowly you figure it out. I guess, you know, people have to recognize also that it will take years, right, for a company to become completely sustainable. So maybe they feel like, you know, for new businesses that are listening, it's like, where do I start?
5% at a time.
Right.
If you're manufacturing overseas, bring 5% of it back to the United States per year, and then, you know,
I think just start.
Start counting again.
Yeah, just start. I think there is a level of sort of just like fear. Big and small brands are like, I'm not doing enough, or I don't know how to, I don't know. And I think that the more we can just be super open and collaborative and say like, we're not here to say we're 100% spinner or 100% right or anything, but we're trying. And I think that the more that can happen, the further and faster it will move.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. We really encourage our client to talk about their journey and not just the goals and the target. Often they say, we're not ready yet. You know, we are afraid of criticism, or strategy is not perfect, or goals are not ambitious enough. But it's about communicating the fact that you actually care about this. And, you know, no one is expecting you to have all answers. This is a process. And, you know, you really, there is a big opportunity if you're able to share that process with consumers so that they feel part of that sustainability journey.
And I think from a design or a brand point of view, asking for it from your mills, asking for your manufacturers, like tell them that that's what you want, because it's still, it from a designer, it still starts at the materials and the processes. And so there's so much innovation happening, but also the more you can kind of just express that we want that, I think that also they'll know that
it
the demand's there.
Lot. Yeah. Like the factory I work with, they don't do mass production. They're very clear on that. And I think that's why it works so well, that we match each other's needs. And when we started off, you know, they knew, okay, I want to follow eco-friendly practices, but they had no idea what. They had no idea, like, they had to keep filling this bag with all the waste fabrics that they usually would throw away. But, you know, now in our second year, they know exactly what they have to kind of be careful about, and they want to actually start recycling their waste as well. So, you know, it's great that I think we all learn from each other as well. You know, I learned, for example, a company, Reformation, you know, the whole scaling, you know, they have this, the carbon footprint scaling and then auditing how they keep across each product. I loved what they did. And, you know, I would love to do that for Agati as well. So learning what each company is doing and just kind of bettering each other through those learnings, I think is good.
Luna, how did you get into being a consultant on ethical fashion?
How long do we have? Well, I think, you know, I studied human rights, and, you know, obviously human rights and CSR, sustainability, these are all interconnected topics. So, you know, I started working with different companies operating in different sectors, and maybe because I'm originally from Paris, I always had a big interest in the fashion industry and luxury sector. And honestly, I had the pleasure to work with some of, you know, the most exciting brands, and I really saw the challenges, but also the big opportunities in this sector that are so interesting to work on at the moment. Yeah.
And I want to remind our listeners that there's a nonprofit here in New York called Fab Scrap that has a facility in Brooklyn where they collect scrap fabric from factories, and they collect scrap rolls. And if you go and volunteer there for an afternoon, you can take fabric home with you. Or you can go there and swap with them, or whatever you need to do. Talk to Fab Scrap. They can help with these issues if you're here in New York. I'm not sure that they've expanded to other cities yet, but
I definitely intend to. Thank you for reminding. It was in my list. One afternoon before I go back, I want to go and sit and volunteer. Let's see how it is.
Have you
been there? It's
no, like, but I think
what they're doing,
what they're doing is great,
right? We need a lot more of these. Yeah, especially like if they could go to the bigger corporations, and there's a lot of waste happening there. Mm. You know, we tried to use some dead stock. There's this great store in LA, and they bring over all these premium fabrics that companies actually tell them, if you don't take it, it's going to go to landfill, or we have to destroy it. And then they just get at this amazing prices, these beautiful fabrics. So if a lot of these, you know, companies or stores come in the supply chain, it could be such a big united movement.
So big companies like H&M, which now has a plan, I don't know.
Why do we keep talking
about
that?
To 2030.
That?
Well, because I don't. Because this is the reason I'm bringing it up.
Yeah.
Are there other major companies that are working towards becoming completely sustainable that are actually putting a lot of waste out there right now. I mean, they're one of the big ones, so.
I think Nike is another one. Levi's.
Yeah. Right.
PVH.
PVH,
yeah,
right.
LVMH, Kering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kering is a big one, yeah.
I mean, even as a city, San Francisco has banned the sale of fur, from September or something like that, even as city initiatives. I think I was at a small talk, intimate talk. There was a gathering in San Francisco where one of the Levi's innovation head was there, and he was taking us through how, you know, they take care of denim, wash, and, you know, the cotton they use and all of that to a great extent. And I don't think anyone can say they are 100% sustainable because it's so complicated, mm-hmm. so difficult to achieve that. But all these big brands, even Gap, they mentioned by 2020 they would be using organic cotton.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are big initiatives by big names.
Yeah. It's the copycats that always worry me, that a lot of the high-end designers would use fur within the last couple of years, but they'd say, well, we're sourcing it from ethical facility. Well, you're killing an animal that's not a food animal and using its skin. How is that ethical? But beyond that, the lower end brands that then copy the trends or copy the big names are not using those ethical sources. So you have, you know, the top of the pyramid thinks they're all this very clean, but then everybody's following them and creating mud. And it's, you know, if you're the leader in the marketplace and everybody wants to be you, you got to think about how they're going to try to be you, because and communicate probably how these ethical things work and how to look for the earmarks of them before you put stuff out there that could go wrong when somebody else tries to copy it.
Also, a lot of questions from the shoppers, from the consumers, is also adding to bigger companies mm-hmm. being responsible. Yeah. I don't know if that comes across, Luna, in your space,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, and especially with employees. I've heard this many times that during interviews, employees are actually asking about how sustainable the company is. So that's another, another value proposition.
Yeah. Every time I go into a big store, I ask where their Made in USA clothing is, and just, you know, oh, can you ask your manager? I don't mention that I do American Fashion Podcast for them in the industry. I just, you know, try to put the idea out there that this should be in your store. But any final thoughts here? No?
To the point that you just added?
Okay.
Or in general?
Sure. No, in at all.
For example, I make everything in India.
Yeah.
And I did face that dilemma in the beginning, you know, like, should I try to be local when it comes to manufacturing? Because that takes away a lot of the carbon footprint. I think it became like creating the balance same way of being only sustainable and not aesthetically appealing, or, you know, because my DNA is art and sort of embroidery especially and working with culture. And that kind of got translated very well into finished products that could work within my budget, within Agati's company budget, and that worked well from India. So I think there are many companies, even in America, who say made in New York or made in USA, whereas they've pretty much just actually assembled the last part of it and then they use that tag. So there is a lot of mixed information, I think, that goes on as well. And none of us have that transparency, you know, to say that, okay, actually, this was completely made here. But I do want to also kind of support, you know, the local market that you know, where we operate, New York, San Francisco. So we work with a lot of, you know, female founders. The staff, my staff is a lot more like local, sort of budding young youth who we can kind of train and, you know, develop more into sustainable thinking. So, yeah. It's been interesting as a challenge, actually.
I was in an event last week and someone gave me a T-shirt, and on the tag it said, "Assembled in Nicaragua from Made in USA components," like on the tag of the T-shirt.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting, definitely.
So, Saloni, you've worked with some huge names in fashion. What did you learn from you know, Diane von Furstenberg and Zac Posen and Naeem Khan and Oscar de la Renta about fashion? What did you get from working for those big companies?
So, I always like to clarify this because maybe it's just me being me. So I interned at these places, but for long lengths of time. And I went from owning my own business in Singapore, where I was a self-taught designer, and then coming to Parsons and graduating in design, and then moving to see these amazing fashion houses was obviously a dream. But learning from them was immense. It wasn't something related to sustainability or, you know, eco-friendly philosophies, but on design, I think. Like, I was working across the head cutter at Oscar de la Renta and watching her techniques and her methods, and couture is definitely something that, you know, I'm fascinated and I'm passionate about. So that was something amazing to learn and see firsthand. DVF, I worked with the head of fabric, you know, sourcing, and how they take decisions on the different textures and the import of beautiful textile. Again, nothing really we could put aside as eco-friendly. You know, they were eco-friendly, but it wasn't really an umbrella there, but just beautiful textile. You know, how do you do textile manipulation? So I think from like Zac Posen and Naeem Khan, again, there's so much around the running a business, multitasking, draping, fixing embroidery, you know. So everything I would say is more, very much more towards design side, yeah.
Was there anything that you learned there or that you learned in school that was then contradicted from by what you learned about ethical fashion?
Like, contradicted in a sense?
Like, this is the way that you do this part of the fashion assembly process, the of preparing a product development or preparing for manufacturing. This is how it's always been done, but okay, now we have to do it differently.
One thing I learned is there is no set rule, so everyone has their own method. And I realized I have to create my own method, whether right from, you know, the studio rooms where we learn these are the best practices for draping or pattern making, cutting, sewing, to what you actually see in the studios of these big fashion houses. How do you translate that to your small business? It can be very different. So I don't think we should follow any, you know, like I, at least in my perspective, there is something set rule. It's very fast-paced. That is probably that is one thing where we do have very less hours of sleep. But multitasking, perseverance, patience—I think those are probably the common things. But the technicalities of it, you have to develop your own. Yeah.
I want to ask both you and Nicole, how do you sell? Do you have your own stores? Are you e-commerce, wholesale? Where are you in the marketplace?
We're a bit of a mix. We started mostly e-commerce and offline kind of private clients and pop-ups, and we recently started doing wholesale. So we're now building that site out, and then we also do kind of one-off collaborations, which will usually be in between seasons. So yeah, it's a multi-channel strategy.
Who do you collaborate with? Like,
we've done
kind of
a bunch of different things. Designers, brands, hotels, anything that's kind of brand aligned and that makes sense and can be kind of an interesting one-off kind of, not necessarily just story to tell, but just something a bit unexpected. It's usually small, kind of small drops, and it's exclusive and kind of is what it is. Yeah.
For us, it is also a mix of e-commerce, and the brick-and-mortar part would be the pop-ups. I think pop-ups really worked for us because it helps us to kind of keep things within a certain scale. Mm-hmm. And e-commerce is, you know, where everyone is, like shopping online, so reaching that medium as well. I think it takes a lot more of digital marketing to kind of, you know, really scale up the sales numbers for e-commerce. We're working on it. I think it can be very successful, but again, it's very complicated. But pop-ups are something that we have consistently done well. And right now I'm at Flying Solo, amazing concept of just independent designers coming together, you know, where everyone helps each other.
They moved across Soho. They used to be...
Yes, they were at Mulberry. Now they are at West Broadway. You should come and check it out. It's a beautiful space, two floors. And yes, another... one of the transitions from last year to this year for us is... we were very focused at reaching out to the sustainable, you know, community. So we did very specific events that were very much only having sustainable philosophy as an event. But now we are going a little more mainstream, actually a lot more mainstream, because we thought, you know, we have this product that needs to reach out to a much wider audience, very decorative as well as a product. And, you know, we need to share about what is, you know, that eco-friendly clothes can, you know, look beautiful, because people have this preconception. And I think with many companies that's breaking away, that it's very minimalist or it's very much casual wear. But actually there are, you know, beautiful brands out there doing a lot more variety than just, you know, basic wear. So I think, yeah, we want to just take that message forward to the mainstream audience as well. So
I have one thing too, back to, since we're talking about selling, and I know that this is a podcast about American fashion, but I think, you know, Europe's quite a bit ahead of us in terms of sustainability, for lots of reasons, not bad or good. But
some of them legal, they put laws in place.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many, there's culture, there's legal, there's so many things. But we've really started to see retailers jump on board and really ask questions. Currently, most of them international at the moment, but it's the first that I've really seen them show up and not just ask the question, but really get into it and really looking to kind of ingrain it into their entire sales plans for the next 5 years. And I think that... that's really, again, optimistic about that. And I think that American retailers are going to have to do the same thing. And I think they're already thinking about it, but I think they're going to have to really kind of get it together, because it's and we live in such a global world now that if Selfridges has these robust plans and stands behind it, then I think American retailers are going to need to, too. So also optimistic about that.
Yeah, the effort and the demand has to come from everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. You need all set. Same thing with media. Like, media needs to be educated so that they can properly talk about it. That's another huge challenge that we have. Yeah. And at the Copenhagen Fashion Summit, they had two panels called, one was... the S word, and as in sustainability, like, how do you talk about it? Because the minute you say sustainability, everyone's like, and there was another one that was something like, how do we talk about sustainability outside this room? And I think it's, you know, everyone, and there were Vogue editors there, and Vogue Australia has their first ever sustainability at large editor. I think they're the only one to have that, which I thought was incredible. So I think it's really changing, but it's great. It has to come from all sides of the industry. I'm more optimistic than I have been in the last couple of years, and I like to share that optimism, because sometimes it's not always that message.
Yeah, media is a big part of it.
Yeah,
I mean, before, when you said, Charles, you know, why H&M, and it's like, of course I know PVH is doing it and caring, but you're not reading about the efforts, you know.
Absolutely.
Enough.
Well,
they're not talking about
the
one-offs.
Efforts.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think they're talking about it, but in a non-accessible way. I think, you know, having a sustainability report and a sustainability page is great, because when you communicate about your sustainability effort, you really have to communicate for different stakeholders. So investors, you know, the civil society, consumers. And I think that when you look at consumers specifically, that sustainability report or page doesn't work, and you need to communicate at a product level. So, you know, if you look at ASOS, for instance, I think they've done a good job at sort of defining the different attributes of, you know, what makes a product sustainable, and that's maybe fair trade or you know, craftsmanship, or, you know, different attributes that they care about, and they explain what these attributes are. They define them in an accessible way, and they also created this logo to be able to recognize these products, and, you know, the way they communicate it is very you know, it's very sexy, it's fun, and I think that's definitely the direction that we're headed to.
It's difficult for a multi-label online store to be able to keep track of all that information.
It is. Yeah, it is. It requires a lot of collaborative effort. Yeah.
I mean, it's so much work. I think no matter who's working on it, it's so much work. It's a lot harder, more expensive, takes more time to produce and make things sustainably, to sell them sustainably, to let you know. And I think being very level set, again, like being open about those things, we're not saying we're 100%, we're not saying we're perfect, but we're all like trying, because it is this, you know, it's a massive feat, and there's no one's completely perfect at it, and won't be for maybe ever. You know,
Luna, do you see the big brands figuring out that they need to be in niches? Are they still trying to do, you know, a collection that works for everybody or for a very broad consumer, or are they actually getting into the smaller spaces now?
I think it depends. I think brands are trying to understand different profiles of consumers. So mothers, for instance, parents, there was this study about how parents actually, especially millennial parents, care more about sustainability. So, you know, creating products that are tailored to their specific needs, or, you know, millennials is another interesting category. So I think there are more efforts, but, you know, they're big brands. And I think that, you know, being, and that's another point that you raised, you know, they are big brands, and I think civil society and society broadly tend to criticize, you know, these big companies. But, you know, when you think about it, they do have the scale to make an impact, and they are creating jobs. So, you know, maybe their business model is to create clothes for everybody, but, you know, they can also, there is an opportunity for them to also be sustainable while doing that.
Yeah. It's like if you have a speedboat, you can really outmaneuver a big transport ship, but once the transport ship actually gets turned around, they can move so much more cargo than a speedboat. So
right.
We've got all these little startup brands that are doing great ethical stuff, but if we can get a couple of the big tankers turned around and going in the ethical direction, it changes everything.
Yeah,
that's a great visual analogy.
Yeah,
I love that. I really just like saw that all happen.
I see a podcast.
Yes. Any more questions?
All good.
No?
No, I don't think so.
Thanks for
this
having me.
This was great.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
really thanks
enjoyed
for
coming.
It
was great meeting you all as well.
Yeah.
Keep up the
AmericanFashionPodcast.com is our website. AFPOD is our Twitter handle. And on Instagram, we are at American Fashion Show. There's a Be a Guest form on our website. You can also give us feedback through the website, through voicemail at 646-979-8709, or by writing to info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. We occasionally do live events, and to get on the list for free tickets to our live shows, click the live show link also on our website. American Fashion Podcast is produced by the Fashion Media Center for Mouth Media Network. Listen to our sister shows, Fashion is Your Business, Material is Your Business, and Beauty is Your Business, also on Mouth Media Network. This and other episodes are copyrighted by Open Source Business Incorporated and Mouth Media Network Incorporated, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends, remain in force, keep making things beautiful, and keep listening. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.